questions that could reveal your purpose in life? What if there were questions that could surface the change most meaningful to you? And what if answering those questions would give you the power to ignite? Welcome to the Illumify Game Changer podcast. These are big conversations that lead to self-discovery. Together, let's embark on the leader's journey and ignite meaningful change. Jonathan is about to hit pay dirt after all the digging he's done to surface the change most meaningful to him. In mere minutes, he expresses what he now sees that could be but doesn't yet exist. His vision of it becomes even more vivid and compelling as he reflects. Jonathan, this Illuminate card may have your name on it. Please read the next question.
Here we go. What's your vision? What is your vision? Vision speaks to the potential of the future, to something that hasn't yet been experienced, but that is possible and within reach. Imagine you could change the world in some way. What do you see that could be, should be, or must be? Right. My vision is of a shared home for the part of the world that I've grown up in and lived most of my life. And which is already full of history and culture and different peoples who were born here like me, but have also come here from many other lands. A shared home where all of us together live together, not only in peace, but in full loving respect of each other. In full loving respect of our differences, but fully conscious of our need for each other. I think in a nutshell, that's it.
Do you want to name this home?
It's our shared European home. It's our shared European home.
Can I read it back to you?
Please.
You added a little additional detail I'm going to omit just in this reading.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
My vision is of our shared European home, where all of us together live together in peace and full loving respect for each other and for our differences, but fully conscious of our need for each other.
That as a first stab, that feels okay.
Writer in you, yeah.
Feels okay.
The unedited version,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah, first stab in my own words. You said it very well, but as my own first stab,
yeah.
It, it it's a start. Yeah.
I think that's a mic drop. So first of all, Jonathan, that's a record. I want you to know you now hold the world's record for answering that question. So quickly, brilliantly, that very question can take in other contexts. And I've proven that through some of my other work. 3 months of conversations. Bravo on that. And it doesn't surprise me. Can you share any further reflections you have on your answer to and experience of that question?
Yes. The first is an important omission. I know why I forgot this, but it needs to go back in as a word. I did not use the word freedom. Mm-hmm. That is absolutely fundamental. If it wasn't right in there from the beginning, it's because, as I've suggested several times in our various conversations, I believe we have celebrated excessively over the last 20, 30, 40 years, the idea of the individual, which has led to individualism. And I think that's why I probably didn't immediately put this there, so the word freedom. But if I think back to our conversations together, and what we really mean by dignity, that very rich conversation we had about dignity of the soul, and the sacred soul of each individual, that is also about individual freedom. That individual's freedom can never be violated, cannot be violated.
Beautiful.
A person with dignity behind bars, rightly or wrongly, is still free. The people, mostly Jews in the concentration camps, the Nazi concentration camps, who, in spite of everything, in spite of being in the uttermost darkness, often made a choice to live out their final seconds and minutes and hours well, to live well until the very end, under the most impossible circumstances. And I think it was Viktor Frankl,
In Search for Meaning?
Yeah, who wrote about this. Now, why do I say that? Because that's the freedom that goes hand in hand with dignity, the dignity of the soul, the human spirit that could not be broken. So that these people had lost all freedom forever, and they knew that. They would have known that. They knew what they were facing, but they still had the individual freedom, their freedom and their dignity to live well and have respect for each other until the end. So that's where freedom is for me. That freedom is not just an individual human right, but something much deeper, and that goes hand in hand with the soul and the dignity and the integrity of the soul. So that's my first reflection. We need to get freedom back in there. Yeah. The rest I'm happy with. And then there's a question to myself, which is, okay, what's new? What's new here? We've heard all this before. You've gone on and on about the European Union and the European Union's constitution. Article 2, you've just repeated what's in Article 2. Well, the values of the European Union. And that's where I'm challenging myself to go beyond that. Mm. I think so far, and this is where I hope it's new, is that we have seen these values sometimes as a list. Uh-huh. It's a list. This is a list. It's a list of our values, and we can trot them out: human rights, rule of law, parliamentary democracy, freedom of the press. What the vision I'm trying to articulate here is that we have a full acceptance of the tensions within these values. It's these are not all self-evident. How do we reconcile the idea of freedom? How do we reconcile the idea of individual freedom with the idea that we need each other, that we have a need for each other? And let me underline what I've said on a number of occasions. It's not just our need for each other in terms of friendship and solidarity, but we need each other to become who we are supposed to be, our true developed selves. The idea that a good society, a good education system allows its young people to flourish. It's all about allowing each individual to reach their full potential, whatever that is. That you to get there, you have to recognize our need for each other. Respect for each other as we are different. We've talked about the tension within the European idea of unity and diversity, unity in diversity, perhaps the most difficult tension to reconcile, but we have to do it. In all our ethnic and historical and linguistic diversity, our sexual diversity, which today feels more fluid and beyond labels than ever before, and rightly so. In all of our human complexity and diversity, how do we find the unity of purpose to take action together? So that's perhaps the hardest challenge. But what this vision is saying is these tensions are themselves the lifeblood of the community. These tensions are the lifeblood of the community. So we don't lose energy, we don't waste time, we don't lose energy by trying to reconcile these competing needs, these competing values. We gain energy from it. We get strength from it. It should invigorate our political debates. The political debates in this community, the one I've described, would be charged with passion and energy, because this goes to what life is about. What is our human life? What does it mean to be human? This vision is not, it's not so much an answer to the question, well, what's Article 2 in your constitution? It's an answer to the question, what does it mean to be human? And why I hope or I feel that this vision is not purely political. It's not purely political, but could overspill a little bit and go beyond the pages, the margins of a political constitution. That would be my hope. So this is not a list. It's a vision. It's a vision, and therefore not a list. And I don't need to tell you, Marianne, because this is the world you've worked in. A vision, and even a strategy. Yeah, let's bring it down to the level of strategy. A strategy is not a list of things we're going to do over the next 3 years. It's not a to-do list. It's not a list of tactics. So those are my first reflections, mm-hmm. looking back on that, mm-hmm. that vision.
Yeah. Brilliant. So I know that you want to just wordsmith a bit and leave you to it. I just want to ask you to contrast what you've just illustrated, you know, even including the political debate and level of it, or what wherever you want to go with this. Given this is your vision, what do you see as the current state of all of that?
Um, this is maybe why I asked myself, well, is this new? Okay. Part of that questioning is, well, this is the mantra of 1989. This is what 1989 was about. This is why the wall crumbled. This is why we unified and brought in many countries from the former Soviet bloc and brought them into the European Union. But maybe this is also my answer to my own question, because we now feel the difference, not the failures, that would be too strong, but perhaps the shortcomings of the 1989 settlement. I think as Europeans, we have to look at why we've lost our way since then. It's very difficult questions. So I think that's part of it, my questioning. Is this really new, or am I just trying to revive the idealism of 1989?
Could it also be, Jonathan, that you personally have seen it for a long time, so it may not be new to you?
Yes, I think there could be that. There could be that. Yeah. No, there's something there. I think it's also because if I've avoided the word Europe, actually, as far as I could, in articulating that first breath of the vision, I deliberately avoided.
You said where you grew up, et cetera. You described
that's also in response to, I think, a very good and helpful prompting that has come from you throughout our conversations to not to go down too quickly into the actual day-to-day reality. Let's stay above. Let's look for the overarching here. What are we trying to get to? So I've followed your prompting on that, which is good and right and helpful.
Thank you. So
I deliberately avoided the word Europe because it does go beyond. It does go beyond Europe, this vision. As I said, I think that's why I ended up with the idea that it comes off the page, it goes beyond the page of a political constitution, but has a wider significance about how we see each other and our relationships with each other, wherever we live. But I do think if we do just for a second confine it to Europe, I do feel we have lost some of this. We have lost some of this. For example, there has sometimes been this more transactional view of Europe. Europe is something that allows us to travel.
Trade, travel,
cross borders without showing our passport. So that we can have our education in different countries. You know, mobility, the whole idea of mobility, great. Those were the moments where I perhaps started to feel the limitations. Mobility, well, great if you can afford it. what if you can't? People getting passionate about, I don't want to show my passport when I cross borders. Listen to people in Brussels, in the capital, get very passionate about this. Well, if you don't have the money to travel, I'm sorry, mobility's not mm-hmm. important for you. I mean, this sounds as if I'm getting into the detail, but this stuff matters, yeah? Because what are we trying to do here in this vision? This vision is also, you know, if I look through these words again, It's a vision that's talking about the community, the home. Yeah? It starts with the home. So seeing the idea of a shared home.
Do you see a correlation at all between the concept of home and freedom? Since those are such key terms.
Yeah. No, that's a good question. Because again, we might be tempted to see them as opposites or...
Yes. Or unrelated.
Yes. I mean, I'm trying to go back to something you said yourself, Catherine, about being in survival mode when one is anxious, or can be many reasons, but we talked a lot about anxiety. Mm-hmm. So going as you go through a difficult period, an anxious period, you're in survival mode. You can't thrive in any way. You can't express yourself. You can't open up because you're hunkering down. Mm-hmm. So this is the idea of home as a place where you feel safe, but not in the sense where you're hunkering down and pulling down the blinds, closing the door. It's not a home that encloses you. That's important. Yeah, we talked earlier about the need to defend our external borders, to defend our walls, to keep the door shut. If there are people out there who want to destroy us, this is not controversial. But that if we are to thrive and to feel safe and to have the freedom, so linking to your word, how do we reconcile this with freedom? Then we do have to feel safe, but not because we're enclosed inside the walls of a house. That doesn't work. We all love the coziness of a house. I'm not denying that. We all know that feeling if we've been lucky enough to have a warm, safe home. That feeling is great. Nothing wrong with that. But in the vision here, it's a bigger vision of home, which is much more than just the safety and the coziness of those walls and the roof. Important that they are. I've just found my thread again, so let me just get it back on the record before I lose it. Sure. Quickly. I think... What draws me to this vision is, and why, and again, it's this idea of why it's not a wish list, it's not a to-do list, it's not just a list of values, which is what we already have. That's the old. We have that already. I think what this vision is trying to do is also see, this is the challenge. This is the challenge. Can we come up with a vision of life together amongst ourselves, amongst our community, and not just family and friends, but a community of 60 million people, let's say. Can we have a vision for a community of that size, which is founded, rooted in these values, but where the values and the home, the sense of home that they build, in some way respects and corresponds to what is inside each of us. So a vision of community and home, and yes, let's call it a political vision. There's nothing wrong with that. Politics in its broadest sense, about making choices. So can we find a political vision, a vision of this shared home where the architecture of it, the values behind it, not only project outwards and give us a sense of what the good life is, how we live together, what it means to be human, but also correspond to some degree, to some reality, to our human interior, our human spirit. So when I talked about the reconciling of competing values, I believe very deeply, I know in my heart that... each human being is struggling each day to reconcile these competing tensions. I want to do what I want to do. I want to be free. I want to do this today. Okay, that's one voice. The voice which says, but yeah, but I have these duties and responsibilities today. I need to do this. I need to do that. The voice which says, my tribe, nobody understands our tribe. I'm going to stick to my tribe. I'm going to be with my tribe. I'm going to defend my tribe. And then the other voice says, but hang on, your next door neighbor is from a completely different tribe. You're going to have to find some way of, what if you need sugar and you have to go around and knock on the door and get some sugar? You're going to have to get over your tribe. Silly example, but you get my point. So this is my tribe. I want to stick him inside my, I feel I'm at home in my tribe. This is where I'm, these are my people. This is where I feel comfortable. But the need for good, at the very least, good civil relations with our neighbours. I don't think that's enough, but let's leave it at that modest level for now. The need for good neighbourly relations. So I think this challenge we face every day as humans, reconciling these competing visions of ourselves, competing interests, competing urges, the urge to do, to not to do, the urge to be free, the urge to recognize and fulfill our duties, the urge to be alone, the urge to be in community, the urge to speak, the urge to be silent, the urge to compete, the urge to share. All of that's going on inside our human soul. And the vision that I'm trying to articulate here is one where it's exterior, it's political, it's about how we organize our society, but it's in tune with our humanity. And that's, I think that's what the vision is searching for. It's almost, I remember yesterday, Marianne, we had a conversation about the tree, the image of a tree. And what do we see? We see the branches. What we see visibly is the trunk, the branches, the leaves in spring and in summer. And it branches out. And we forget that there is not quite a mirror image. And I'm struggling with this because how often do we see the roots of a tree, you know, fully uprooted and bared to the air?
Exposed.
Exposed. We don't. Sometimes when we do see them in a forest where a tree has fallen over in the wind, a hurricane, whatever, we actually then get a glimpse. So it's not a mirror image, but there is... What I'm looking for is the idea that the roots are not the same as the branches. They're getting sustenance from, one gets sustenance from the soil, the others get sustenance from sunlight and rain. But there is nonetheless a mirror image here where the noise and the debate, you know, the parliamentary debate within our own minds, the chamber of our mind and our soul as well. And we have to search, plumb the depths of our soul to know what the right thing to do is. All of that's going on, and we are fragmented. We are fragmented within ourselves, divided within ourselves, and we work towards unity within ourselves. Is that not the mirror image of what we're trying to see in this vision that I'm trying to articulate here, where outside, so in the branches of the tree, in the air, we're trying to do something very similar in different ways. This is about sunlight and getting the sustenance from sunlight and rain out there in the upper world of this vision, but that's what it's trying to do. I think this vision is trying to marry the two: our inner human fragmentation and how we deal with that, how we deal with our competing urges, and then on the outside how we do the same, but together as a community, where the challenge is no harder or easier, but perhaps more urgent because we have to live together.
So something in me wants to put a name to you, a moniker. And let's start with that. What would you self-name? What could come up for you initially? And then let's talk about it.
I'm going to struggle to find a human name. But I'm going to go with something you said, Marianne, which I liked very much and I think gets to the heart of what we're trying to do here, certainly in terms of language. Huh? So if we're looking at the relationship between the vision and the language, so language as the lifeblood of the vision, not just its articulation through words and sentences, but something that gives it energy, the lifeblood of the vision coming from language, coming from words. And you said something about we need to rescue words that have been lost or tarnished, sullied, misused, violated. They need rescuing and restoring to their original sense and value, bringing them back to life, almost regenerating those words. So
and given words are part of your language.
Yeah.
Mastery.
So the idea of rescuing and as somebody who somebody who sometimes feels that he's spent too much time indoors with words and admires the people who are out there using their bodies and hands to do really important things. A rescuer, yeah. That appeals to me.
Yeah. Mm. And as you use your gift for language, as you just did now, to convey that incredibly compelling vision of what could be, it strikes me in trying to find a name for you in that role, and I just feel compelled to do that, Jonathan. What came up for me is the David and Goliath contrast between what is now and what could be. So of those two, one being a mighty force of, I won't qualify it, and one being perceptibly a smaller force or resource, tell me first, would you identify with either, and if so, which one?
Who wouldn't want to be David? Looking at the life of the man who created the sculpture, Michelangelo, you can look at it and walk around the statue and see many different things. And what struck me now is, and this seems very, maybe this aspect seems relevant to our discussion. If I remember correctly, when the sculpture was first completed, the idea was to have it outside, and I believe on the top, above one of the great basilica or cathedrals in Florence, and it would be it's sending a signal to the neighbours, including Rome, and I think Richard at some point says, you know, giving the finger, David giving the finger to the neighbours, the other parts of, you know, the other principalities of and kingdoms of Italy at the time, what we call Italy today, and Rome among them. So very much a political symbol, this sculpture as a political symbol. You know, we are, this is who we are, and we're, you know, we're giving you the finger. So very aggressive.
Knowing who you are.
Mm.
Claiming that ground.
Yeah. I don't know if that's me. I felt like that. That's the license of the football stadium. When you go into the football stadium, you're allowed to to give the finger.
that's hysterical.
That's because.
But think of the perspective of David's perspective, that high up in that basilica.
Yes.
And we talked about vision and perspective.
Mm.
And so, if you for a second imagine yourself as that David.
Oh, yes. Well, you've triggered something there, Marianne, and this goes deep to the heart of me. And it's again something that I've not always understood about myself: the desire to be the underdog, the desire to be the underdog. a deep desire. I remember, again, this is one of these weird childhood memories that I might be sharing now for the first time. I don't remember. Where I remember if I was in our schoolyard and I was picking one of the, you know, I was a captain sometimes in our schoolyard, not the school team, this is just playing during the break, yeah, lunch break. And if I was picking a team, I remember deliberately picking a weaker team, deliberately picking a weaker team.
Out of empathy for those members?
No idea. I'm saying this as looking back at my 11-year-old self, where I don't think I had much empathy as an 11-year-old.
Possibly not.
I liked chocolate. But I don't know if I had a lot of empathy.
But somehow you wanted to play as a team, to be the underdog.
Yeah.
To exceed expectations. What happened with those underdog teams?
I can't remember. Honestly, can't remember. But I do remember very strongly. So it's not just, you know, there's that. I'm sure many countries around the world have this. That meme, everybody likes an underdog. Yeah, I don't think that's peculiar to the English.
I don't know. I don't.
Maybe
I don't relate to that.
No, maybe it is. Might be an English thing.
Maybe it's an English thing.
Yeah, everybody likes an underdog.
The Americans don't like an underdog.
No, oof. I think the English do.
Yeah, maybe they do. You know, that might explain a lot.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe. So this deliberate picking of a team where I wanted a weaker team. Yeah.
Let's play with that for a second. Sometimes people do things because they can.
Mm.
And when we can, it generally means that we don't have a lack. We don't have a deprivation within us that we seek to fill.
Yeah.
That can very well fall under the category of integrity.
Maybe.
Dignity.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe. Yes. Yeah.
Honoring the dignity that you saw.
Possibly. Again, I can see how that works now. At the time.
Yes,
it's intuitive.
Yeah, intuitive, maybe. Also, this is very dangerous. We're on very dangerous territory trying to understand what this 11-year-old boy was doing, but I'm looking for things that do ring true with me. Mm-hmm. The sense that we would make up the difference through our work. There is a modern football manager who just hinted at this. This felt familiar. I apologize now to those of you here who are not football fans, but there was a French manager of a London team, Arsene Wenger. Manager of Arsenal, very glorious period for him, mostly in the 90s, was at his peak, I think. And I have a vague sense that, well, I don't know if he said this publicly, but his club was often run as a tight ship. Yeah, they didn't want to spend too much money. He didn't always have the budgets that other teams had. And you sense that he reveled in that. Sense that he enjoyed that, that it wasn't a frustration or...
Because he could overcome it?
Yeah.
Wasn't even a handicap?
Yeah, but he wanted to get beyond that. So there's something there. There's something there. Yeah. We're not going to get to the bottom of this, the soul of this 11-year-old boy. But there is something there.
There is something there. Catherine, you have a son turning 11 next week. Mm-hmm. Can you add any
happy birthday to
perspective?
Him?
Perspective, yes.
Thank you.
Well, you're sorry to interrupt, but your son as well, yes, but marrying today.
To say how old my son is.
No, but we will say happy birthday.
Yes, happy
because
birthday,
it's today.
Alex. Thank you for lending us your flat.
Yeah. I always found and continue to find biological age quite a distorted way of viewing the capacity and the wealth of contribution that an individual can bring to the world. And if the sacred dignity of that baby is not squashed or squandered, that manifests every year, year after year, perhaps even into adulthood. And it's the people who are able to maintain that sacred dignity who are peculiar. They're not of the norm. And they often do things that are not explainable, not rational, not always self-serving.
Mm-hmm. I just want to put a dot on this. Because you've spoken, your initial response to that David and Goliath scenario, you actually said, who wouldn't want to be David? Mm. So do I have your permission as we continue at certain junctures to call you David?
You do.
Awesome.
It's going to feel very weird, but you have permission.
Thank you. There are two things that distinguish leaders from others. First is your ability to look at what is now and see what could be instead. Second is that you be willing and able to ignite it. But first you have to see it. This is the 11th question Jonathan has answered in his quest to illuminate the change most meaningful to him. Did you notice how he pieced it together, choosing his words with such care and precision? And how he then ensured it contained all of the essential elements: a shared home, freedom, diversity, sacred dignity. He now has a clear and compelling vision of the change most meaningful to him. Where does he go from here? The leader's journey continues. I'm Marianne Gobet. Thank you for accompanying us on the leader's journey. To fully experience the passage to igniting meaningful change, subscribe to the Illumify Game Changer podcast. To learn more about the Illumify Game Changer and how to embark on your own leader's journey, please visit Illumify's website at illumifyinstitute.com. You matter. Step up. Speak up. Together, let's ignite meaningful change.